and super forecasters have more than two hands. On the one hand, Saudi Arabia runs few risks in letting oil prices remain low because it has large financial reserves, wrote a super forecaster, trying to decide if the Saudis would agree to OPEC production cuts in November 2014. On the other hand, Saudi Arabia needs higher prices to support higher social spending, to buy obedience to the monarchy. Yet on the third hand, the Saudis may believe they can't control the drivers of the price dive, like the drilling frenzy in North America and falling global demand. So they may see production cuts as futile. Net answer? Feels no-ish, 80%. As it turns out, the Saudis did not support production cuts, much to the shock of many experts. That is, Dragonfly Eye in operation. And yes, it is mentally demanding. Super forecasters pursue point-counterpoint discussions routinely, and they keep at them long past the point where most people would succumb to migraines. They are the polar opposite of the people who blurt out 10 cents on the cognitive reflection test, which is why, to the surprise of no one, they did superbly on the CRT. Forget the old advice to think twice. Super forecasters often think thrice, and sometimes they are just warming up to do a deeper dive analysis. Yet these are ordinary people. Forecasting is their hobby. Their only reward is a gift certificate and bragging rights on Facebook. Why do they put so much into it? One answer is, it's fun. Need for cognition is the psychological term for the tendency to engage in and enjoy hard mental slogs. People high in need for cognition are the sort who like crosswords and Sudoku puzzles. The harder the better. And super forecasters score high in need for cognition tests. An element of personality is also likely involved. In personality psychology, one of the big five traits is openness to experience, which has various dimensions, including preference for variety and intellectual curiosity. It's unmistakable in many super forecasters. Most people who are not from Ghana would find a question like, "Who will win the presidential election in Ghana?" pointless. They wouldn't know where to start, or why to bother. But when I put that hypothetical question to Doug Lorch and asked for his reaction, he simply said, "Well, here's an opportunity to learn something about Ghana." But ultimately, as with intelligence, this has less to do with traits someone possesses and more to do with behavior. A brilliant puzzle solver may have the raw material for forecasting, but if he doesn't also have an appetite for questioning basic, emotionally charged beliefs, he will often be at a disadvantage relative to a less intelligent person who has a greater capacity for self-critical thinking. It's not the raw crunching power you have that matters most. It's what you do with it. Look at Doug Lorch. His natural inclination is obvious, but he doesn't assume it will see him through. He cultivates it. Doug knows that when people read for pleasure, they naturally gravitate to the like-minded. So he created a database containing hundreds of information sources, from the New York Times to obscure blogs, that are tagged by their ideological orientation, subject matter, and geographical origin. Then wrote a program that selects what he should read next using criteria that emphasize diversity. Thanks to Doug's simple invention, he is sure to constantly encounter different perspectives. Doug is not merely open-minded, he is actively open-minded. Active open-mindedness, AOM, is a concept coined by the psychologist Jonathan Baron, who has an office next to mine at the University of Pennsylvania. Baron's test for AOM asks whether you agree or disagree with statements like, "People should take into consideration evidence that goes against their beliefs." It is more useful to pay attention to those who disagree with you than to pay attention to those who agree. Changing your mind is a sign of weakness. Intuition is the best guide in making decisions. It is important to persevere in your beliefs, even when evidence is brought to bear against them. Quite predictably, super forecasters score highly on Baron's test. But more important, super forecasters illustrate the concept. They walk the talk. For super forecasters, beliefs are hypotheses to be tested, not treasures to be guarded. It would be facile to reduce super forecasting to a bumper sticker slogan, but if I had to, that would be it. Chapter 6. Superquants?
We live in the era of big data. Vast, proliferating information technology networks churn out staggering quantities of information that can be analyzed by data scientists armed with powerful computers and arcane math. Order and meaning are extracted. Reality is seen and foreseen like never before. And most of us, let's be honest with ourselves, don't have the dimmest idea how data scientists do what they do. We find it a little intimidating, if not dazzling. As the scientist and science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke famously observed, "Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic." As an assistant professor of mathematics at Cornell, Lionel Levine is one of the magicians. His resume lists an A.B. in math from Harvard, a Ph.D. in math from Berkeley, a string of prestigious grants and fellowships, and a longer string of papers with occult titles like Scaling Limits for Internal Aggregation Models with Multiple Sources. As one expects of math wizards, he is young. He graduated from Harvard the same year the intelligence community decided it was 100% certain that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Levine is also a super forecaster. And while he is an extreme case, he underscores a central feature of super forecasters. They have a way with numbers. Most aced a brief test of basic numeracy that asked questions like, "The chance of getting a viral infection is 0.05% out of 10,000 people. About how many of them are expected to get infected?" The answer is 5. And numeracy is just as evident on their resumes. Many have backgrounds in math, science, or computer programming. Even Joshua Frankel, the Brooklyn filmmaker now living in the world of the arts, attended a New York high school that specialized in math and science, and his first job after graduating from college involved the creation of visual effects using computer animation. I have yet to find a super forecaster who isn't comfortable with numbers, and most are more than capable of putting them to practical use. And they do, occasionally. When Bill Flack is asked to forecast something like currency exchange rates, he will go into historical changes in the rate and build a Monte Carlo model based on that. That's basic stuff for the cognoscenti. It is as obscure as ancient Aramaic for everyone else. On Wall Street, math wizards are called quants, and the math they use can get a lot more esoteric than Monte Carlo models. Given super forecasters' affinity for data, it would be reasonable to suspect that it explains their superb results. An algorithmic sleight of hand, a whispered statistical spell, and presto, a startlingly accurate forecast. Numbers people might like that conclusion, but for those who haven't done any calculus since high school and are now in a cold sweat because they just read the word calculus, it would put a moat and a castle wall between them and super forecasting. There is no moat and no castle wall. While super forecasters do occasionally deploy their own explicit math models or consult other people's, that's rare. The great majority of their forecasts are simply the product of careful thought and nuanced judgment. I can think of a couple of questions where a little bit of math was useful, Lionel Levine recalled about his own forecasting, but otherwise he relies on subjective judgment. It's all, you know, balancing, finding relevant information and deciding how relevant is this really. How much should it really affect my forecast? Not using math is even a point of pride for the math professor. People would just assume that his forecasting success was thanks to math, he said. So I kind of, in a contrarian way, set out to prove that I can be a good forecaster without using any. But the fact that super forecasters are almost uniformly highly numerate people is not mere coincidence. Superior numeracy does help super forecasters, but not because it lets them tap into arcane math models that divine the future. The truth is simpler, subtler, and much more interesting. Where's Osama? Early in 2011, the attention of the U.S. intelligence community was riveted on a peculiar compound. Its high walls encircled a cluster of buildings, which was normal in this wealthy neighborhood of the Pakistani city of Abbottabad. But the compound's occupants were unknown,
and clearly wanted to stay that way. That was unusual. And there were bits and strands of evidence that collectively suggested this was the residence of Osama bin Laden. That was approaching unique. Had they finally located the terrorist mastermind almost a decade after the 9/11 attacks? Everyone knows the answer to that question now. But the analysts did not then. Each had to make a difficult judgment that would lead to the launch of a military assault inside a volatile nation armed with nuclear weapons. Those judgments, and their consequences, would later be dramatized in the movie Zero Dark Thirty. "I'm about to go look the president in the eye, and what I'd like to know, no fucking bullshit, is where everyone stands on this thing," says the actor James Gandolfini, playing CIA director Leon Panetta, in Zero Dark Thirty. He sits at the head of a conference table and glares. Now, very simply, is he there or is he not fucking there? The deputy director answers first. "We don't deal in certainty," he says. "We deal in probability. I'd say there's a 60% probability he's there." The fictional Panetta points to the next person. "I concur," he says. "60%. "I'm at 80%, the next in line says. "Their OPSEC, operational security, convinces me." "You guys ever agree on anything?" Panetta asks. So it goes around the table, from one person to the next. 60%, one says. 80%. 60%. Panetta leans back in his chair and sighs. This is a clusterfuck, isn't it? Let's pause the movie here. What does the fictional Leon Panetta want more than anything? Agreement. He wants each person to come to the same conclusion so he can be sure that that conclusion is correct, or at least the best available. Most people in that position would feel the same way. Agreement is reassuring. Disagreement is, well, we may not use the same colorful description as the fictional Leon Panetta, but most would share the sentiment. But the fictional Leon Panetta is wrong. The people at the table were asked to independently judge a difficult problem and tell the CIA director what they sincerely believed. Even if they all looked at the same evidence, and there's likely to be some variation, it is unlikely they would all reach precisely the same conclusion. They are different people. They have different educations, training, experiences, and personalities. A smart executive will not expect universal agreement and will treat its appearance as a warning flag that groupthink has taken hold. An array of judgments is welcome proof that the people around the table are actually thinking for themselves and offering their unique perspectives. The fictional Leon Panetta should have been delighted when he heard different judgments from different people. It was the wisdom of the crowd gift-wrapped. All he had to do was synthesize the judgments. A simple averaging would be a good start. Or he could do a weighted averaging, so that those whose judgment he most respects get more say in the collective conclusion. Either way, it is dragonfly eye at work. I asked the real Leon Panetta about this famous scene, and he confirmed that something like it did happen. A lot of these people were intelligence analysts, people who had been involved in operations for a period of time. There was a lot of experience in that room, he recalled, but not a lot of agreement. Judgments varied, from people that thought the chances were as low as 30% to 40%, to people that thought it was 90% and above, and it varied everywhere in between. But the real Leon Panetta, a former congressman, chief of staff to President Clinton, and Secretary of Defense to President Obama, had a completely different reaction to that diversity than the fictional Leon Panetta. He welcomed it. I encouraged the people around me not to tell me what they thought I wanted to hear, but what they believed, and to be honest, Panetta said. When he was chief of staff to the president, he considered obtaining and presenting diverse views to be a critical part of his job. The real and fictional Leon Panettas are a study in contrasts. Now, let's press play on the movie again. After the fictional Leon Panetta expresses disgust with a lack of consensus, Maya, the hero of Zero Dark Thirty, gets her chance. She has been sitting at the back of the room, steaming. 100% he's there, she declares. Okay, fine, 95%, because I know certainty freaks you guys out. But it's 100. The fictional Panetta is impressed. While others mule about uncertainty, Maya has the blunt force of a battering ram. After the compound was discovered, she was so sure Bin Laden was there she wanted it bombed to rubble immediately. When weeks went by without any attack, she scrawled the number of days that had passed on the window of her superior. We watched her stomp up and write 21 in big red digits, circling it for emphasis. Later she wrote 98, 99, 100, and underscored it in thick magic marker. We felt her frustration. Maya is right. Bin Laden is there. Ignore the others. The fictional Panetta is with Maya and the audience. The others wouldn't commit themselves to a yes or no, he tells an aide later, because they are cowed. Probabilities are for weaklings. Press pause again. Think about how the fictional Leon Panetta thinks. He sees only two options. Yes, Bin Laden is there. No, he is not. There are only two settings on his mental dial. There is no maybe, let alone settings for degrees of maybe. Judging by how that scene in Zero Dark Thirty plays out, the filmmakers respect that. They are betting the audience will too. Is Osama bin Laden there? Yes or no? This is no fucking bullshit thinking. That's how Maya thinks, and she's right. Or so it seems until you engage System 2 and think twice. In reality, Maya is unreasonable. Given the evidence at hand, it was likely that the man in the compound was bin Laden. One could even argue it was highly probable. But 100%? Absolutely certain? No chance whatsoever that it was not him. No. The man in the compound could have been a different terrorist, or a drug trafficker, an Afghan warlord, an arms dealer, or maybe a wealthy Pakistani businessman suffering from paranoid schizophrenia. Even if the likelihood of each alternative being true were tiny, they would easily add up to 1%, 2%, 5% or more. So we can't be 100% certain that it is Osama bin Laden. Do such fine-grained distinctions matter? Well, the intelligence community was once so sure Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction that they did not explore the possibility that he did not. Yes, they matter. Of course, as Maya was stomping about, there was an objective truth. Bin Laden was there. So Maya's claim was correct, but it was more extreme than the evidence could support. Meaning she was right but unreasonable. The mirror image of the wrong but reasonable position the intelligence community would have been in if it had scaled back the slam dunk to a 60 or 70% chance that Saddam Hussein had WMDs. The final outcome, happy for Maya, unhappy for the IC, doesn't change that. The real Leon Panetta understands process-outcome paradoxes like this, and he is much less keen on certainty than the fictional Leon Panetta. Nothing is 100%, he said several times during our interview. The real Leon Panetta thinks like a super forecaster. The third setting. A similar scene plays out in a book written by the journalist Mark Bowden. Only this time the man at the head of the table isn't a fictional Leon Panetta. It's the real Barack Obama. Sitting in the White House's legendary Situation Room, Obama listened as an array of CIA officers expressed their opinions on the identity of the man in the mysterious Pakistani compound. The CIA's team leader told the president he was almost sure it was bin Laden. He put his confidence level at 95%, Mark Bowden wrote in The Finish, The Killing of Osama bin Laden, Bowden's account of the decision-making behind one of the most famous commando raids in history. A second CIA officer agreed with the first, but others were less sanguine. Four senior officers at the Directorate of National Intelligence had reviewed the case and written out their own opinions, Bowden recounted. Most seemed to place their confidence level at about 80%. Some were as low as 40 or even 30%. Another officer said he was 60% confident it was bin Laden in the compound. Okay, this is a probability thing, the president said in response, according to Bowden's account. Bowden editorializes. Ever since the agency's erroneous call a decade earlier that Saddam Hussein was hiding weapons of mass destruction, a finding that had kicked off a long and very costly war,
The CIA had instituted an almost comically elaborate process for weighing certainty. It was like trying to contrive a mathematical formula for good judgment. Bowden was clearly not impressed by the CIA's use of numbers and probabilities. Neither was Barack Obama, according to Bowden. What you ended up with, as the president was finding, and as he would later explain to me, was not more certainty, but more confusion. Bowden reported that Obama told him in a later interview, "In this situation, what you started to get was probabilities that disguised uncertainty, as opposed to actually providing you with useful information." Bowden then wrote that Obama had no trouble admitting it to himself. If he acted on this, he was going to be taking a gamble, pure and simple. A big gamble. After listening to the widely ranging opinions, Obama addressed the room. "This is 50-50, he said. That silenced everyone. "Look, guys, this is a flip of a coin. I can't base this decision on the notion that we have any greater certainty than that." Bowden clearly admires Obama's conclusion. Should he? The information Bowden provides is sketchy, but it appears that the median estimate of the CIA officers, the wisdom of the crowd, was around 70%. And yet Obama declares the reality to be 50-50. What does he mean by that? We have to be careful here, because there are actually several possibilities. One is that Obama means it literally. He heard an array of views and settled on 50% as the probability closest to the mark. If so, he's misguided. The collective judgment is higher than that, and based on Bowden's account, he has no reasonable basis for thinking 50% is more accurate. It's a number plucked out of the air. But as researchers have shown, people who use 50% or 50-50 often do not mean it literally. They mean, "I'm not sure," or "it's uncertain," or more simply, "maybe." Given the context, I suspect that's what Obama had in mind. If so, that may have been reasonable. Obama was an executive making a critical decision. He may well have felt that he would order the strike if there was any significant possibility that bin Laden was in the compound. It didn't matter whether the probability was 90%, 70%, or perhaps even 30%. So rather than waste time trying to nail down a number, he cut the discussion short and moved on. Of course, I don't know if that was Obama's thinking. And there is another possible explanation, one that is much less defensible. Like the fictional Leon Panetta, Obama may have been bothered by the wide variation in estimates. The disagreement made him think they were unreliable. So he retreated to what probability theorists call the ignorance prior. The state of knowledge you are in before you know whether the coin will land heads or tails, or, in this case, whether Osama will be in the master bedroom when the Navy SEALs come knocking. And that was a mistake, because it meant Obama did not make full use of the information available at the table. But unlike that of the fictional Leon Panetta, Obama's mental dial didn't have just two settings. It had a third. Maybe. So that's where he settled. Bowden's account reminded me of an offhand remark that Amos Tversky made some 30 years ago, when we served on that National Research Council committee charged with preventing nuclear war. In dealing with probabilities, he said, most people only have three settings: gonna happen, not gonna happen, and maybe. Amos had an impish sense of humor. He also appreciated the absurdity of an academic committee on a mission to save the world. So I am 98% sure he was joking, and 99% sure his joke captures a basic truth about human judgment. Probability for the Stone Age. Human beings have coped with uncertainty for as long as we have been recognizably human. And for almost all that time, we didn't have access to statistical models of uncertainty because they didn't exist. It was remarkably late in history, arguably as late as the 1713 publication of Jacob Bernoulli's Ars Conjectandi, before the best minds started to think seriously about probability. Before that, people had no choice but to rely on the tip-of-your-nose perspective. You see a shadow moving in the long grass. Should you worry about lions? You try to think of an example of a lion attacking from the long grass. If the example comes to mind easily, run. As we saw in Chapter 2, that's your System 1 at work.
If the response is strong enough, it can produce a binary conclusion. Yes, it's a lion, or no, it's not a lion. But if it's weaker, it can produce an unsettling middle possibility. Maybe it's a lion. What the tip of your nose perspective will not deliver is a judgment so fine-grained that it can distinguish between, say, a 60% chance that it is a lion and an 80% chance. That takes slow, conscious, careful thought. Of course, when you are dealing with the pressing existential problems our ancestors faced, it was rarely necessary to make such fine distinctions. It may not even have been desirable. A three-setting dial gives quick, clear directions. Is that a lion? Yes, equals run. Maybe, equals stay alert. No, equals relax. The ability to distinguish between a 60% probability and an 80% probability would add little. In fact, a more fine-grained analysis could slow you down and get you killed. In this light, the preference for two- and three-setting mental dials makes sense. And lots of research underscores the point. A parent willing to pay something to reduce her child's risk of contracting a serious disease from 10% to 5% may be willing to pay 2 to 3 times as much to reduce the risk from 5% to 0%. Why is a decline from 5% to 0% so much more valuable than a decline from 10% to 5%? Because it delivers more than a 5% reduction in risk. It delivers certainty. Both 0% and 100% weigh far more heavily in our minds than the mathematical models of economists say they should. Again, this is not surprising if you think about the world in which our brain evolved. There was always at least a tiny chance a lion was lurking in the vicinity, or a snake, or someone who covets your hut and is carrying a club, or any of the countless other threats people faced. But our ancestors couldn't maintain a state of constant alert. The cognitive cost would have been too great. They needed worry-free zones. The solution? Ignore small chances and use the two-setting dial as much as possible. Either it is a lion or it isn't. Only when something undeniably falls between those two settings, only when we are compelled, do we turn the mental dial to maybe. Harry Truman once joked that he wanted to hear from a one-armed economist, because he was sick of hearing, on the one hand, on the other, a joke that bears more than a passing resemblance to Tversky's. We want answers. A confident yes or no is satisfying in a way that maybe never is. A fact that helps to explain why the media so often turn to hedgehogs, who are sure they know what is coming, no matter how bad their forecasting records may be. Of course, it's not always wrong to prefer a confident judgment. All else being equal, our answers to questions like, does France have more people than Italy, are likelier to be right when we are confident they are right than when we are not. Confidence and accuracy are positively correlated. But research shows we exaggerate the size of the correlation. For instance, people trust more confident financial advisors over those who are less confident, even when their track records are identical. And people equate confidence and competence, which makes the forecaster who says something has a middling probability of happening less worthy of respect. As one study noted, people took such judgments as indications the forecasters were either generally incompetent, ignorant of the facts in a given case, or lazy, unwilling to expend the effort required to gather information that would justify greater confidence. This sort of primal thinking goes a long way to explaining why so many people have a poor grasp of probability. Some of it can be chalked up to simple ignorance and misunderstanding, like people who think that a 70% chance of rain in Los Angeles means it will rain 70% of the day, but not the other 30%, or it will rain in 70% of Los Angeles, but not the other 30%, or 70% of forecasters think it will rain, but 30% don't. But there is something much more fundamental underlying mistakes like these. To grasp the meaning of a 70% chance of rain tomorrow, we have to understand that rain may or may not happen, and that over 100 days on which we forecast chances of rain, if our forecasts are good, it should rain on 70% of them and be dry on the rest. nothing could be further removed from our natural inclination to think, it will rain or it won't rain, or if you insist, maybe it will rain. The deeply counterintuitive nature of probability explains why even very sophisticated people often make elementary mistakes. When David Leonhardt claimed a prediction market's forecast was wrong, because it had said there was a 75% chance a law would be struck down and it wasn't, I was pretty sure that if someone had pointed out his error to him, he would have slapped his forehead and said, "Of course." I had that suspicion confirmed later, when Leonhardt wrote an excellent column about exactly this trap. If a forecaster says there is a 74% chance the Republicans will win control of the Senate in an upcoming election, Leonhardt warned readers, do not conclude the forecast was wrong if the party doesn't take the Senate, because a 74% chance it will also means a 26% chance it won't. The confusion caused by the three-setting mental dial is pervasive. Robert Rubin, the former Treasury Secretary, told me how he and his then-deputy Larry Summers would often be frustrated when they briefed top policymakers in the White House and Congress, because people would treat an 80% probability that something would happen as a certainty that it would. You almost had to pound the table to say, yes, there's a high probability, but this also might not happen, Rubin said. But the way people think, they seem to translate a high probability into, this will happen. And yet, if we were to take these presumably educated, accomplished people out of that context, sit them down in a classroom and tell them that the statement, there is an 80% chance that something will happen, means there is a 20% chance it won't, they would surely roll their eyes and say, that's obvious. But outside of a classroom, away from abstractions, when dealing with real issues, these educated, accomplished people reverted to the intuitive. Only when the probabilities were closer to even did they easily grasp that the outcome may or may not happen, Rubin said. If you say something is 60-40, people kind of get the idea. Amos Tversky died, far too young, in 1996, but that would have made him smile. Probability for the Information Age. Scientists come at probability in a radically different way. They relish uncertainty, or at least accept it, because in scientific models of reality, certainty is illusory. Leon Panetta may not be a scientist, but he captured that insight perfectly when he said, nothing is 100%. That may be a little surprising. Most people would identify science with certainty, wrote the mathematician and statistician William Byers. Certainty, they feel, is a state of affairs with no downside. So the most desirable situation would be one of absolute certainty. Scientific results and theories seem to promise such certainty. In the popular mind, scientists generate facts and chisel them into granite tablets. This collection of facts is what we call science. As the work of accumulating facts proceeds, uncertainty is pushed back. The ultimate goal of science is uncertainty's total eradication. But that is a very 19th century view of science. One of 20th century science's great accomplishments has been to show that uncertainty is an uneradicable element of reality. Uncertainty is real, Byers writes. It is the dream of total certainty that is an illusion. This is true both at the margin of scientific knowledge and at what currently appears to be its core. Scientific facts that look as solid as rocks to one generation of scientists can be crushed to dust beneath the advances of the next. All scientific knowledge is tentative. Nothing is chiseled in granite. In practice, of course, scientists do use the language of certainty, but only because it is cumbersome whenever you assert a fact to say, although we have a substantial body of evidence to support this conclusion, and we hold it with a high degree of confidence, it remains possible, albeit extremely improbable, that new evidence or arguments may compel us to revise our view of this matter. But there is always supposed to be an invisible asterisk when scientists say, this is true, because nothing is certain. And yes, that is true of my work too, including everything in this book. Sorry about that. If nothing is certain, it follows that the 2 and 3 setting mental dials are fatally flawed. Yes and no express certainty. They have to go. The only setting that remains is maybe, the one setting people intuitively want to avoid. Of course, a 1-setting dial would be useless. Is that a lion? Maybe. Will they find Polonium and Yasser Arafat's remains? Maybe. Is the man in the mysterious compound Osama bin Laden? Maybe. So, maybe has to be subdivided into degrees of probability. One way to do that is with vague terms like probably and unlikely. But as we have seen, that introduces dangerous ambiguity, which is why scientists prefer numbers, and those numbers should be as finely subdivided as forecasters can manage. That might mean 10%, 20%, 30%, or 10%, 15%, 20%, or 10%, 11%, 12%. The finer grain the better, as long as the granularity captures real distinctions. Meaning that if outcomes you say have an 11% chance of happening really do occur 1% less often than 12% outcomes and 1% more often than 10% outcomes. This complex mental dial is the basis of probabilistic thinking. Robert Rubin is a probabilistic thinker. As a student at Harvard, he heard a lecture in which a philosophy professor argued there is no provable certainty, and it just clicked with everything I'd sort of thought, he told me. It became the axiom that guided his thinking through 26 years at Goldman Sachs, as an advisor to President Bill Clinton, and as Secretary of the Treasury. It's in the title of his autobiography, In an Uncertain World. By rejecting certainty, everything became a matter of probability for Rubin, and he wanted as much precision as possible. One of the first times I met with him, he asked me if a bill would make it through Congress, and I said, absolutely, a young Treasury aide told the journalist Jacob Weisberg. He didn't like that one bit. Now I say the probability is 60%, and we can argue over whether it's 59 or 60%. During his tenure in the Clinton administration, a golden era of soaring stocks and Rubinomics, Rubin was praised lavishly. After the crash of 2008, Rubin was criticized with equal vigor. But whether Rubin is a hero or a villain, or something in between, isn't my domain of expertise. What's interesting to me is how so many people reacted when Rubin's probabilistic thinking was laid out in a 1998 New York Times feature story. They found it startlingly counterintuitive, challenging. Professionals pinned Rubin's thoughts on thinking to cubicle walls, alongside inspirational messages and photos of their kids. People in all kinds of circumstances have told me it affected them, he recounted in 2003. That reaction bemused Rubin. He thought he had said nothing surprising. But when he expanded on the theme in his autobiography, the reaction was the same. More than a decade later, I still have people come to me when I speak at panels or things and say, I have a copy of the book, can you sign it? Or, it was really important to me and interesting because of this discussion of probabilities, Rubin says. I can't say why what seems obvious to me seems to a lot of people to be insightful. Probabilistic thinking and the 2 and 3 setting mental dials that come more naturally to us are like fish and birds. They are fundamentally different creatures. Each rests on different assumptions about reality and how to cope with it. And each can seem surpassingly strange to someone accustomed to thinking the other way. Uncertain supers. Robert Rubin would not have to pound the table to make super forecasters understand that an 80% chance of something happening implies a 20% chance it won't. Thanks in part to their superior numeracy, super forecasters, like scientists and mathematicians, tend to be probabilistic thinkers. An awareness of irreducible uncertainty is the core of probabilistic thinking, but it's a tricky thing to measure. To do that, we took advantage of a distinction that philosophers have proposed between epistemic and aleatory uncertainty. Epistemic uncertainty is something you don't know but is, at least in theory, knowable. If you want to predict the workings of a mystery machine, skilled engineers could, in theory, pry it open and figure it out. Mastering mechanisms is a prototypical clock-like forecasting challenge, Aleatory uncertainty is something you not only don't know, it is unknowable. No matter how much you want to know whether it will rain in Philadelphia 1 year from now, no matter how many great meteorologists you consult, you can't outguess the seasonal averages. You are dealing with an intractable cloud-like problem with uncertainty that is impossible, even in theory, to eliminate. Aleatory uncertainty ensures life will always have surprises, regardless of how carefully we plan. Superforecasters grasp this deep truth better than most. When they sense that a question is loaded with irreducible uncertainty, say a currency market question, they have learned to be cautious, keeping their initial estimates inside the shades of maybe zone between 35% and 65%, and moving out tentatively. They know the cloudier the outlook, the harder it is to beat that dart-throwing chimpanzee. Another nugget of evidence comes from the phrase 50-50. To careful probabilistic thinkers, 50% is just one in a huge range of settings, so they are no likelier to use it than 49% or 51%. Forecasters who use a three-setting mental dial are much likelier to use 50% when they are asked to make probabilistic judgments, because they use it as a stand-in for maybe. Hence, we should expect frequent users of 50% to be less accurate. And that's exactly what the tournament data show. I once asked Brian Labatt, a super forecaster from Montreal, what he liked to read. Both fiction and nonfiction, he said. How much of each, I asked. I would say 70%. A long pause. No, 65-35, nonfiction to fiction. That's remarkably precise for a casual conversation. Even when making formal forecasts in the IARPA tournament, ordinary forecasters were not usually that precise. Instead, they tended to stick to the tens, meaning they might say something was 30% likely or 40%, but not 35%, much less 37%. Super forecasters were much more granular. Fully one-third of their forecasts used the single percentage point scale, meaning they would think carefully and decide that the chance of something happening was, say, 3%. Rather than 4%. Like the Treasury aide taught to think in fine-grained possibilities by his boss, Robert Rubin, super forecasters try to be so precise that they sometimes debate differences that most of us see as inconsequential. Whether the correct probability is 5% or 1%, or whether it is a fraction of 1% close enough to zero to justify rounding down. These are not debates about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, because sometimes precision on that scale matters. It means moving from a world in which a threat or an opportunity is extremely improbable but possible to one in which it is categorically impossible, which matters if the consequences of the improbable happening are great enough. Imagine an Ebola outbreak or funding the next Google. Now, I have urged the reader to be skeptical, and the skeptic may have doubts about this. It's easy to impress people by stroking your chin and declaring, there is a 73% probability Apple stock will finish the year 24% above where it started. Toss in a few technical terms most people don't understand, stochastic this and regression that, and you can use people's justified respect for math and science to get them nodding along. This is granularity as bafflegab. It is unfortunately common. So how can we know that the granularity we see among superforecasters is meaningful? How can we be sure that when Brian Labatt makes an initial estimate of 70%, but then stops himself and adjusts it to 65%, the change is likely to produce a more accurate estimate? The answer lies on the tournament data. Barbara Mellers has shown that granularity predicts accuracy. The average forecaster who sticks with the tens, 20%, 30%, 40%, is less accurate than the finer-grained forecaster who uses fives, 20%, 25%, 30%, and still less accurate than the even finer-grained forecaster who uses ones, 20%, 21%, 22%. As a further test, she rounded forecasts to make them less granular, so a forecast at the greatest granularity possible in the tournament, single percentage points, would be rounded to the nearest five, and then the nearest 10. This way, all of the forecasts were made one level less granular. She then recalculated Brier scores and discovered that superforecasters lost accuracy in response to even the smallest scale rounding, to the nearest 0.05, whereas regular forecasters lost little even from rounding four times as large, to the nearest 0.2. Brian Labatt's granularity isn't baffle gap, it is precision, and a key reason why he is a superforecaster. Most people never attempt to be as precise as Brian, preferring to stick with what they know, which is the two- or three-setting mental model. That is a serious mistake. As the legendary investor Charlie Munger sagely observed, if you don't get this elementary but mildly unnatural mathematics of elementary probability into your repertoire, then you go through a long life like a one-legged man in an ass-kicking contest. Even very sophisticated people and organizations don't push themselves to Brian's level. To take just one example, the National Intelligence Council, NIC, which produces the national intelligence estimates that inform ultra-sensitive decisions like whether to invade Iraq or negotiate with Iran, asks its analysts to make judgments on a 5 or 7 degree scale. That's a big improvement on a 2 or 3 setting dial, but it still falls short of what the most committed superforecasters can achieve on many questions. I've known people who served on the NIC, and I suspect they are selling themselves short. The NIC, or any other organization with top-flight people, could get similar results if they valued and encouraged it, and they should. The reward, remember, is a clear perception of the future, and that's invaluable in the ass-kicking contest of life. But what does it all mean? In the Kurt Vonnegut classic Slaughterhouse-Five, an American prisoner of war muttered something a guard did not like. The guard knew English, and he hauled the American out of ranks, knocked him down, Vonnegut wrote. The American was astonished. He stood up shakily, spitting blood. He had 2 teeth knocked out. He had meant no harm by what he'd said, evidently had no idea that the guard would hear and understand. "Why me?" he asked the guard. The guard shoved him back in ranks. "Why you? Why anybody?" he said. Vonnegut drums this theme relentlessly. "Why me?" moans Billy Pilgrim when he's abducted by aliens. "That is a very earthling question to ask, Mr. Pilgrim," the aliens respond. "Why you? Why us, for that matter? Why anything?" Only the naive ask, why. Those who see reality more clearly don't bother. It's a trenchant insight. When something unlikely and important happens, it's deeply human to ask why. The religious message that whatever happens, even tragedy, is a meaningful part of a divine plan is ancient. And however one feels about religion, there's no question that this sort of thinking can be consoling and help people endure the otherwise unendurable. Oprah Winfrey, a woman who overcame adversity to achieve stupendous success, personifies and promotes the idea. Using secular language, she said in a commencement address at Harvard University that, "There is no such thing as failure. Failure is just life trying to move us in another direction. Learn from every mistake because every experience, encounter, and particularly your mistakes are there to teach you and force you into being who you are. Everything happens for a reason. Everything has a purpose." In the final episode of her landmark TV show, Winfrey made essentially the same point in explicitly religious language. "I understand the manifestation of grace and God, so I know there are no coincidences. There are none, only divine order here." Religion is not the only way to satisfy the yearning for meaning. Psychologists find that many atheists also see meaning in the significant events in their lives. And a majority of atheists say they believe in fate, defined as the view that events happen for a reason, and that there is an underlying order to life that determines how events turn out. Meaning is a basic human need. As much research shows, the ability to find it is a marker of a healthy, resilient mind. Among survivors of the 9/11 attacks, for example, those who saw meaning in the atrocity were less likely to suffer post-traumatic stress responses. But as psychologically beneficial as this thinking may be, it sits uneasily with a scientific worldview. Science doesn't tackle why questions about the purpose of life. It sticks to how questions that focus on causation and probabilities. Snow building up on the side of a mountain may slip and start an avalanche, or it may not. Until it happens, or it doesn't, it could go either way. It is not predetermined by God or fate or anything else. It is not meant to be. It has no meaning. Maybe suggests that, contra Einstein, God does play dice with the cosmos. Thus, probabilistic thinking and divine order thinking are in tension. Like oil and water, chance and fate do not mix. And to the extent that we allow our thoughts to move in the direction of fate, we undermine our ability to think probabilistically. Most people tend to prefer fate. With the psychologist Laura Cray and other colleagues, I tested the effect of counterfactual thinking, which is thinking about how something might have turned out differently than it actually did. In one experiment, students at Northwestern University wrote a short essay explaining how they chose to go to Northwestern. Half of them were then asked to list ways that things could have turned out differently. Finally, all of them rated how strongly they agreed with three statements. My decision to come to Northwestern defines who I am. Coming to Northwestern has added meaning to my life, and my decision to come to Northwestern was one of the most significant choices of my life. As expected, students who had engaged in counterfactual thinking, imagining the different choices they might have made, imbued their decision to come to Northwestern with more meaning. A second experiment asked participants to think of a close friend. Again, imagining how things might have turned out differently caused people to imbue the relationship with deeper significance. A third experiment asked people to identify a turning point in their lives. Half were asked to describe only the facts, what happened, when it happened, who was involved, what they were thinking and feeling. The other half were asked to describe how their lives would be now if the turning point had not occurred. All participants then judged the degree to which the turning point was a product of fate. As expected, those who had contemplated alternative paths in life saw the path taken as meant to be. Think about the love of your life and the countless events that had to happen as they did to bring the two of you together. If you had studied that night rather than gone to the party, or your spouse had walked a bit faster and not missed that train, or you had accepted your friend's invitation to go out of town that weekend. The what-ifs stretch over the horizon. Once, it was vanishingly unlikely that you two would meet. And yet, you did. What do you make of that? Most people don't think, wow, what luck. Instead, they take the sheer improbability of it happening, and the fact it happened, as proof it was meant to happen. Something strikingly similar happens on a cosmic scale. Think of the Big Bang, the dominant scientific explanation for the origin of the universe. Big Bang theory tells us how finely tuned the laws of nature need to be for stars, planets, and life to arise. Even tiny deviations and we would not exist. Most people don't respond to that observation by saying, wow, we were lucky. Or by wondering whether billions of Big Bangs generated billions of parallel universes, a few of which turned out by chance to be life-friendly. Some physicists think this way. But most of us suspect that something, perhaps God, was behind it. It was meant to be. Natural as such thinking may be, it is problematic. Lay out the tangled chain of reasoning in a straight line and you see this. The probability that I would meet the love of my life was tiny, but it happened. So it was meant to be. Therefore, the probability that it would happen was 100%. This is beyond dubious. It's incoherent. Logic and psychologic are in tension. A probabilistic thinker will be less distracted by why questions and focus on how. This is no semantic quibble. Why directs us to metaphysics. How sticks with physics. The probabilistic thinker would say, yes, it was extremely improbable that I would meet my partner that night, but I had to be somewhere, and she had to be somewhere, and happily for us, our somewheres coincided. The economist and Nobel laureate Robert Shiller tells the story of how Henry Ford decided to hire workers at the then astonishingly high rate of $5 a day, which convinced both his grandfathers to move to Detroit to work for Ford. If someone had made one of his grandfathers a better job offer, if one of his grandfathers had been kicked in the head by a horse, if someone had convinced Ford he was crazy to pay $5 a day, if an almost infinite number of events had turned out differently, Robert Shiller would not have been born. But rather than see fate in his improbable existence, Shiller repeats the story as an illustration of how radically indeterminate the future is. You tend to believe that history played out in a logical sort of sense, that people ought to have foreseen, but it's not like that, he told me. It's an illusion of hindsight. Even in the face of tragedy, the probabilistic thinker will say, yes, there was an almost infinite number of paths that events could have taken, and it was incredibly unlikely that events would take the path that ended in my child's death. But they had to take a path, and that's the one they took. That's all there is to it. In Kahneman's terms, probabilistic thinkers take the outside view toward even profoundly identity-defining events, seeing them as quasi-random draws from distributions of once possible worlds. Or, in Kurt Vonnegut's terms, why me? Why not me? If it's true that probabilistic thinking is essential to accurate forecasting, and it was meant to happen thinking undermines probabilistic thinking, we should expect super forecasters to be much less inclined to see things as fated. To test this, we probed their reactions to pro-fate statements like these. Events unfold according to God's plan. Everything happens for a reason. There are no accidents or coincidences. We also asked them about pro-probability statements like these. Nothing is inevitable. Even major events like World War II or 9/11 could have turned out very differently. Randomness is often a factor in our personal lives. We put the same questions to regular volunteer forecasters, undergraduates at the University of Pennsylvania, and a broad cross-section of adult Americans. On a 9-point fate score, where 1 is total rejection of it was meant to happen thinking, and 9 is a complete embrace of it, the mean score of adult Americans fell in the middle of the scale. The Penn undergrads were a little lower. The regular forecasters were a little lower still. And the super forecasters got the lowest score of all, firmly on the rejection of fate side. For both the super forecasters and the regulars, we also compared individual fate scores with Breyer scores and found a significant correlation, meaning the more a forecaster inclined toward it was meant to happen thinking, the less accurate her forecasts were. Or, put more positively, the more a forecaster embraced probabilistic thinking, the more accurate she was. So finding meaning in events is positively correlated with well-being, but negatively correlated with foresight. That sets up a depressing possibility. Is misery the price of accuracy? I don't know. But this book is not about how to be happy. It's about how to be accurate, and the super forecasters show that probabilistic thinking is essential for that. I'll leave the existential issues to others. Chapter 7. Super News Junkies? Super forecasting isn't a paint-by-numbers method, but super forecasters often tackle questions in a roughly similar way, one that any of us can follow. Unpack the question into components. Distinguish as sharply as you can between the known and unknown, and leave no assumptions unscrutinized. Adopt the outside view and put the problem into a comparative perspective that downplays its uniqueness and treats it as a special case of a wider class of phenomena. Then adopt the inside view that plays up the uniqueness of the problem. Also, explore the similarities and differences between your views and those of others, and pay special attention to prediction markets and other methods of extracting wisdom from crowds. Synthesize all these different views into a single vision as acute as that of a dragonfly. Finally, express your judgment as precisely as you can, using a finely grained scale of probability. Done well, this process is as demanding as it sounds, taking a lot of time and mental energy. And yet it is literally just the beginning. Forecasts aren't like drawing lottery tickets that you can buy and file away until the big draw. They're judgments that are based on available information and that should be updated in light of changing information. If new polls show a candidate has surged into a comfortable lead, you should boost the probability that the candidate will win. If a competitor unexpectedly declares bankruptcy, revise expected sales accordingly. The IARPA tournament was no different. After Bill Flack did all his difficult initial work and concluded there was a 60% chance that polonium would be detected in Yasser Arafat's remains, he could raise or lower his forecast as often as he liked, for any reason. So he followed the news closely and updated his forecast whenever he saw good reason to do so. This is obviously important. A forecast that is updated to reflect the latest available information is likely to be closer to the truth than a forecast that isn't so informed. Devin Duffy is a fantastic updater. He is also a super forecaster with the unusual distinction of having volunteered for the Good Judgment Project because he was unemployed at the age of 36 after losing his job when the factory he worked in closed. The Pittsburgh native is now an income maintenance caseworker with the state government. My most useful talent is the ability to do well on tests, especially multiple choice, Devin told me in an email. This has made me appear more intelligent than I actually am, often even to myself. Needless to say, Devin has a cutting sense of humor. Like many super forecasters, Devin follows developments closely by using Google Alerts. If he makes a forecast about Syrian refugees, for example, the first thing he will do is set an alert for Syrian refugees and UNHCR, which will net any news that mentions both Syrian refugees and the UN agency that monitors their numbers. Devin will set the alert to report daily if he thinks that events may change rapidly, say the risk of a military coup in Thailand, otherwise weekly. Devin reads the alerts as soon as they come in, thinks through what they imply about the future, and updates his forecasts to reflect the new information. In the third season alone, Devin made 2,271 forecasts on 140 questions. That's more than 16 forecasts, on average, for each question. I would attribute my GJP success so far, such as it has been, Devin wrote, to good luck and frequent updating. Devin is not unusual. Super forecasters update much more frequently, on average, than regular forecasters. That obviously matters. An updated forecast is likely to be a better informed forecast, and therefore a more accurate forecast. When the facts change, I change my mind, the legendary British economist John Maynard Keynes declared. What do you do, sir? The super forecasters do likewise. And that is another big reason why they are super. But that raises a suspicion. Maybe all the careful cognitive labor and granular judgment that goes into the initial forecast doesn't explain super forecasters' success. Maybe their forecasts are better simply because they spend a lot more time watching the news and updating. I once asked a famous political scientist who runs a lucrative consultancy providing political forecasts to major corporations, if he would like to try his hand in the IARPA tournament. He was interested until he learned that the tournament required updating. He had no interest in competing with unemployed news junkies, he said. I didn't like his attitude, but I got the point. Super forecasters do monitor the news carefully and factor it into their forecasts, which is bound to give them a big advantage over the less attentive. If that's the decisive factor, then super forecaster's success would tell us nothing more than it helps to pay attention and keep your forecast up to date, which is about as enlightening as being told that when polls show a candidate is surging into a comfortable lead, he is more likely to win. But that's not the whole story. For one thing, super forecasters' initial forecasts were at least 50% more accurate than those of regular forecasters. Even if the tournament had asked for only one forecast and did not permit updating, super forecasters would have won decisively. More important, it is a big mistake to belittle belief updating. It is not about mindlessly adjusting forecasts in response to whatever is on